Extra time.
Hello, welcome back to a very special Christmas edition of Extra Time. Today I'm joined by podcast OG, Chris Hamill. Hello, Chris, how are you?
I'm very good, mate. I am unwashed at current because I'm going to go on a jog straight after this. I've just come straight from a voiceover, so I've warmed up the cords, the vocal cords, so I'm in a good place. What about yourself?
I'm doing it the other way around. I've already been to the gym and I'm doing a voiceover after this.
Nice.
So we'll see who produces the higher level of performance and we can then tailor our our schedule accordingly.
Nice.
You know, like when Patrice Evra went to Juventus and they were like, you've got an egg allergy, you idiot. Like, at 35 years old and suddenly he, you know, developed the ability to like run through time or something.
Didn't he say that brought him to tears when he realised because he was having eggs every morning?
Oh, that is so tragic. Like, egg allergies are rubbish. One of my friends has got one and she just... I don't know. I was just like, what do you do? It's in everything.
Yeah, I did one of those tests, a York test it's called, and mine came back that I had an allergy to hen's eggs and I eat them religiously, which does explain, you know, some of the rumblings that goes on in my intestines, but that's probably a conversation for a different time.
It's a conversation for no time ever, I think. But should we get into it?
Because let's do it.
This Christmas, what we're going to do is take a look back at the year in football, maybe do a little awards for some of the players, some of the managers, and some other stuff, which has really caught our eye over the last 12 months. Chris has brought in some suggestions. I've brought in some suggestions. We're going to roll them out to you and see what you think. So I think we should start in probably the most obvious and probably the most boring place. Just get it out of the way. And that's Player of the Year.
Yes, I agree. This was the most boring section. I put little to no research into this.
Good. Me too. I've got one bullet point. Who have you got? Who have you gone for?
So what I've done is I've listed a bunch of players who qualifies the correct answer for this, right? and then I've put some more interesting ones underneath because I think Lewandowski, probably the outstanding candidate, 13 goals already in 9 starts this campaign, 58 goal involvements in 41 appearances last season. That's only league and UCL. And 4.5 shots last term, second best of his career, 1.2 key passes, 1.9 dribbles, over 2 key passes in the Champions League. There was literally nothing he wasn't doing as a forward player in the year 2020. I get a little bit annoyed, you know, the way we have to straddle the seasons with this. But yeah, he was fantastic just throughout, wasn't he? And there's KDB as well, Mohamed Salah, Sadio Mane, Mbappe, Kane. But then I sort of started to think, what player throughout 2020 was the sort of most important to their club, the most impactful? And in that sense, I started to think of Jamie Vardy, Danny Ings, maybe, you know, Lucy Bronze, Mia Demma at Arsenal. But ultimately, I settled on Lewandowski. But what do you kind of think about that shortlist? Were they the names that sprang to mind with you as well?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, Lewandowski was, to me, the obvious candidate. I mean, he had more combined goal and assist this year than anybody else. Like, Ronaldo and Messi are in second. They've both got 45 this season, this calendar year. Lewandowski's got 51, and he's played one game more than Ronaldo, 5 games fewer than Messi. Plus, of course, you know, winning a treble, like, pretty good.
Yeah, not
and
bad.
Messi, and the thing is about Ronaldo, I think Ronaldo got a lot of penalties this year. Lewandowski didn't. Messi has had a pretty bad start to this season.
Yeah.
Lewandowski hasn't. So I think that consistency needs to be acknowledged, and of course the trophies as well. I mean, the other person I kind of thought of was Bruno Fernandes, because in a way I was kind of like, the best player of the year is probably Lewandowski. You know, maybe Messi, but probably Lewandowski. But the player of the year is in like the player who maybe defined 2020.
Yes.
You could argue was Bruno Fernandes, who went from relative obscurity at the beginning of the year to a Premier League, a superstar in one of the top leagues by the end of the year.
Yeah, it was 34 goal involvements in his first 35 games, wasn't it? Incredible.
Yeah, I mean, I think penalties do count against him when it comes into it. You know, I think the fact is that, like, okay, I was going to say most Man United fans would maybe take De Bruyne over him. I don't think that's necessarily true. I think they, you know, they love Bruno, but I think most people would admit that that De Bruyne is the better player.
Yeah.
And I think that maybe is also where it tips in Lewandowski's favour. Like, I think Lewandowski was the best in his position in the world all year. And Bruno was one of the best in his position in the world all year. And to me, that kind of means that Lewandowski gets a bigger shout. Plus, of course, Lewandowski did it in the Champions League. Bruno, a lot of his goals and assists last season were in the Europa.
Yeah.
So I think those things, and fewer games as well. And I think that has to be factored in too.
And I know we're not supposed to be counting the sort of latter half of 2019, but in my head, I can't help but count that. As in, Robert Lewandowski was doing it in a better league than Bruno, you know, for 6 months leading up to the January transfer window, when Bruno obviously came in, made such a huge impact, and then that momentum is just continued. Like, Lewandowski's consistency, like you said, cannot be underestimated. And it is those fine margins. Like, people think we're nitpicking when we highlight how many penalties that Bruno Fernandes scores. And it's brilliant that he scores them and he's so proficient. But Robert Lewandowski is literally, like, he's putting up two key passes in the Champions League. Well, he was in 1920 when they won it. Like, he's putting up elite creative numbers whilst also scoring pretty much a goal a game. I don't think anyone comes close, to be honest.
Yeah, and I think Man United as well. Like, Man United's results picked up with Bruno, but I don't actually really think Man United are that much better as a team now. Like they're obviously better with Bruno on the pitch than off it, but Man United started the year as like an okay kind of maybe fourth to fifth Premier League side, and that's where they are at the end of the year. Whereas I think people forget, you know, yes, they weren't getting the rub of the green, but
Kovac.
Bayern were in the Christmas break like fourth or fifth in the league. Like they were struggling in the Bundesliga, and probably mostly due to Lewandowski, they went from there to the best side in the world over the course of 2020.
I know there's people very convinced, like up until November, December, weren't they, that Lucien Favre's men were going to do it. I remember having a bet with Doogie that, I mean, I said that Bayern would catch them, and he was pretty staunchly against that point, saying that, you know, this is going to be Borussia Dortmund's year. The momentum was definitely with the black and yellows, wasn't it? But I think he, Lewandowski, wrestled that away from them. And Hansi Flick obviously deserves an enormous amount of credit for that period as well. But it's been maybe a transitional couple of years for Bayern as a whole. Like, you look at the players they've lost, Thiago Alcantara, of course, Robin and Ribery have both departed the last two or three seasons. They've lost an enormous amount of experience, and he's sort of been the figurehead, I guess, in that team over that period, sort of papering over the cracks while Gnabry beds himself into the side, while, I don't know, Joshua Kimmich, his star continues to rise. Like, it's, I wouldn't say transitional is a bit over the top, if you know what I mean. But there's still been some moving parts at Bayern in the last couple of seasons, and people have barely noticed because he's just been so bloody ruthless.
Yeah, and I think in the Champions League as well, like, their defence looked better than it was. Like, the fact they kept clean sheets in some of their games in the latter stages. I don't think they were actually that good defensively. Like, I thought the PSG were going to give them way more trouble in the final because of Alphonso Davies' positioning, you know, and obviously adapting to that. And, you know, Boateng is, we've been talking about him as slowing down now for about 3 years.
Yeah.
And he's still a perfectly good centre-back, but he is, in space in the field, he is a problem.
Yeah.
And
soon, you know, Pavard
coming in as well. Yeah, he was injured pretty much the whole of last season. And they were bedding in Benjamin Pavard, right back. And you're right, you know, when Goretzka joined them, I didn't think he was all that. And he's really blossomed over the last year. But that was something that he was able to do because of the sheer quality of that attacking line. And so, yeah, I think that Lewandowski has really plugged every gap for them this year in a way. Like, Lewandowski, Alaba and Kimmich, to me, are the guys who've just really kept them ticking come what may this season and last season. And for that, I think he really deserves credit. He's the best player on the best team in the world. Like, that makes you player of the year, probably.
Yeah, that sums it up, doesn't it? Pretty much.
Well, shall we move on to manager of the year there? Because you gave a little shout out to Hansi Flick. Mm. And my first bullet point here is Hansi Flick is boring. And also, they haven't been great at the start of this season. When you consider the talent advantage they have of the rest of the league, not only are they not top of the league right now, they don't have the best numbers in the league, the best underlying numbers. Mm. They're behind Leipzig and Dortmund in that regard. I think that there have been some serious defensive frailties exposed. And that quite often happens, you know, right? Like we say in one season, maybe this team isn't as good defensively as we think. And then the next year, they start to get picked apart a little bit.
What's happened with Jimenez, by the way? Has he returned from injury on a consistent basis?
Who?
Have I said the right player? The centre-half they bought from Atletico Madrid. Centre-half come left-back for like 100 million
Hernandez.
Euros. Hernandez. Did I say Jimenez? Always get them confused. Jimenez, Saul and Hernandez. Just like the holy trinity of players that I just mix up. But yeah, Hernandez, sorry.
See, I was trying to think if you meant Javi Martinez.
No.
And then I was just like, he's not significant in any way. he has
Luca Hernandez,
come back.
Yeah, there we go.
Yeah, he has come back, but and I think he's played a bit more left back recently because Alphonso Davies hasn't really played that many minutes this season. But I don't know how they feel about Luca Hernandez. I think that there's a bit of uncertainty at Bayern. But, you know, it looks like Alaba might leave on a free next year. So at that point, they'll probably be glad that they have Hernandez. But they have been a little bit all over the place. Obviously, Kimmich is out, which is a problem for them. Mm. Thiago's gone, which is a problem for them. But Zula's back, which is good. I don't know. I'm not quite sure what the reasons for it are, but they absolutely got pummeled earlier in the season by Hoffenheim.
Yeah.
And they've generally, and when you look at their games recently, it's kind of one of those things where you expect every now and then to see Bayern drawing 1-1 with like Augsburg or something. But you expect that when you look at the shots and the expected goals, it'll be like one of those games where a keeper just stood on his head and was amazing. And it hasn't really been that recently. I think they've taken a little bit of a drop. So I was kind of scouting round for other managers. And I thought, as much as I don't rate him, and I seriously don't rate him, I thought Rudy Garcia probably deserved a shout. Mm. Obviously had that really deep Champions League run. They're the best team in France this season. That's good work from him. But that's not who I've gone for. Let's see who you've gone for first.
All right, fair enough. I was still thinking about Hansi Flick just then because I was actually just going back very, very quickly to the whole Lewandowski issue. And it only confirms our choice. To be honest, I was thinking about the spine of that team over the last two or three seasons. Obviously, Neuer has had to come back from the brink. Thomas Müller has been on a similar journey. Obviously, had an outrageous campaign last season, particularly on an assist front. But he had to come back into form as well, right? Boateng, like you said, Gnabry and Koeman on either wing. Like Lewandowski is the truly outstanding, like world-class component of that side. Like I think they just become a very good side with him in it. And I'm not sure if Hansi Flick plugs that gap with his sort of managerial ability at the moment. You know, if he was to all of a sudden become Lewandowski-less, whereas, you know, some others might, like a Pep and a Klopp. But anyway, let me go back to managers. I have done what I did basically with the last section, reeled off some obvious answers that I wanted to fly through and then touch upon some more interesting candidates. So I had Hansi Flick, Jurgen Klopp. I actually had Thomas Frank down for some reason at Brentford. Not for some reason. He's obviously a very good manager, but I clearly wanted to elaborate on him and then didn't. Marcelo Bielsa. And then I sort of went into De Zerbi at Sassuolo, Martinez at Granada, and Knutsen at FK Bodo Glimt. So a little bit of a kaleidoscope of managers. I think Jurgen Klopp is still the outstanding manager in world football and has demonstrated that in 2020. But these guys deserve praise. Like De Zerbi took Sassuolo to eighth last season. And at the time, well, not at the time of writing, I've not checked the table in a week or so, but Sassuolo were third last time I checked in Serie A and playing some great, adventurous, you know, daring, attacking football on a shoestring pretty much. And the way he's improved players like Locatelli is fantastic. Of course, bought him for, what, 11 mil? Now easily worth 30 mil plus. Big fan of De Zerbi's possession-based football. And I just can't believe the job that Martinez has done at Granada. When they were promoted from the Segunda division, obviously last campaign when they finished seventh was their first season back, He got promoted after spending, I think, close to 60,000 euros.
Jesus.
Which is insane when you think
about
it.
That's like the accountant's fee.
Yeah, like, you consider
that's like what we pay Joe.
If you consider how much money clubs in the Championship are willing to, you know, spend, they're not just willing to spend money, they're willing to gamble their future, a long-term future as an establishment, to get to the Premier League, aren't they?
Yeah,
getting promoted to a top division on $60,000, insane. And then of course Granada finish seventh, and I think they currently sit on the same amount of points as Barcelona. I might be a game week out with some of these stats, to be perfectly honest. But yeah, they've only spent 25 mil since their return, and I think it's gonna. If he puts in another season like last season, he's gonna be at a top 10 club, maybe top 8 club, you know, very soon. His credentials are starting to come together nicely, and then of course Knutsen at Bodo Glimt. I only really read into this because I was scouting a player called Victor Boniface, this 19-year-old Nigerian who's sort of going under the radar there because of some of their players are going over like 1.2 expected goals per 90, and are subsequently being linked with Derby County. So yeah, enjoy that. So Knutsen's, I think Bodo Glimt 2 or 3 years ago only stayed in the division by 3 points, and then in his first season came second, and now they're first, but not just winning the division, they're on track for like a record amount of points, goals, biggest winning margin, and it's a very sort of Leicester-esque story because in Norway clubs in the south dominate, and Bodo Glimt are about as north as you can get. I think Tromsø are the only club that are above them in the Arctic Circle. But it's insane what they've had to operate with, and I suppose against, and the results that they've achieved. And, you know, there's just some cool little anecdotes in there. Like they hired a former fighter pilot to be their mental welfare coach. I don't know if I got the title correct there, but all the players sort of credit their upturn in form to this guy. And it's just great to see, you know, smaller clubs who are thinking a little, you know, using a bit more innovation to sort of get one over the bigger clubs in any respective division. I just love an underdog. So I think he deserves a shout out. Julian Steffens deserves a shout out. Rennes are playing, I think they're comfortably the third or fourth best team in Liga in this campaign, and their budget is way outside, you know, the traditional top 5-6. So he's sort of defying expectation as well. But saying that, I will probably stick with Jurgen Klopp. But those guys deserve more of a mention than I think they've got in the mainstream media, let's say.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is about Klopp, I think that given the season City had last year, he was expected to win the league. Like, if you'd said at the beginning of the season, City are going to have a bad year, you'd expect, therefore, that Liverpool would win the league. And they exited the Champions League a little bit early. So an amazing season from him. But in a way, I struggled there. Because part of this, right, like what you're saying by shouting out these smaller managers or small managers at smaller clubs is pointing out that they've exceeded, you know, they've gone beyond expectation.
Yeah.
Which is really how, you know, you'd want to kind of scout for potential as a manager. You know, like that's why people are excited about Jesse Marsh or Marco Rosa, for instance.
Yeah.
And so I was trying to look for those guys as well, people who did more than was expected this season. I think that you probably have to talk a little bit about Petr Bosz here. Really
nice.
Good season last year, and Leverkusen lost Kai Havertz in the summer, are currently top of the Bundesliga. Like, that, I think, deserves huge credit. I wanted to ask your opinion, actually, about Steven Gerrard, because, of course, you know, Rangers came in second last season again, and this year they're absolutely running away with it, and it remains to be seen whether they can sustain that. But right now, they look like a very good side who are actually extremely competitive in Europe as well. So I wanted to get your take on Gerrard.
Well, that's the most impressive thing, right? This season, like, ignore the kind of the points differential domestically speaking, because I think Celtic are 2 games behind. So that's going to look a little less impressive, you know, if Celtic win those games. And there's a big fixture on the 2nd, or first Old Firm, which, you know, if Neil Lennon loses, he probably loses his job, and that probably confirms Rangers as title victors. So that will become a lot clearer in the next 2 or 3 weeks. But what he's done in Europe is great. Like, they're not just winning, they're winning in style and they're winning convincingly, and they are beating teams with far superior budgets and much better pedigree. Benfica, for example, obviously drew 2 games, but should have got 6 points, I think. And the victory against Galatasaray was extremely impressive. I think that was the last round of qualification, right, for the Europa League. I don't think that was even in the group stage. And then, like, away at Lech Poznan might not sound like much, but Celtic fans would be delighted if they won away at Lech Poznan. Like, such is the like rashness of our European form. Like, we beat Lille in pretty impressive fashion at home, but it was just too little too late by then. Conceding 8 goals to a team that finished third in the Czech division in 1920, you know, confirms Neil Lennon, in my opinion, as out of his depth at that level. So I think Steven Gerrard's improved year on year. I think he was unfortunate not to at least win the League Cup last season, because Rangers absolutely battered Celtic in that final. And had they won that, had they come away with a trophy last season, I think that would have changed perception slightly. It was almost, his season last season was almost dismissed as another sort of total failure. But really, their blueprint has become a lot clearer. It has a startling resemblance to Klopp if you look at the sort of average positions of all the various players at Rangers and at Liverpool. And it's quite clear that's going to be his modus operandi, and that's the job he wants next. And if he has another couple of seasons like he is at Rangers, then, you know, he probably qualifies for it.
Interesting. I mean, I'm quite intrigued. I don't think it'll be that long before a Premier League club tries to get him out of Rangers just because of his cachet in English football.
There should be a step in between Rangers and Liverpool, but I don't think there will be if his stock continues to improve and Klopp does, you know, do that hard exit at, what did he say, 2024?
Something like that. Yeah. I mean, that's another 3 years. I don't know, that kind of gives time. Like, you could imagine a club going and trying to get Gerrard maybe next summer if they win the league, and then maybe he could do 2-3 years elsewhere. I don't know who would be a good shout for him. It's kind of one of those things where, like, if Leicester lost Rodgers somehow, or I'm not really sure, but a club of that sort of level with that kind of setup might be primed for someone like him. But who knows, really? I mean, none of these guys are going to be my manager of the year, I think.
Yeah.
My manager of the year, I think, is Stefano Pioli.
Yes, very good shout. I'm a little bit disappointed I've not mentioned him, actually.
Well, Milan have taken more points than anyone in Italy this year. They've taken 72 points this calendar year in 32 games, which is the best in Italy. It's 8 points ahead of second place Inter. Mm. They've scored the second most goals, 72. Inter have scored 74. They've had the fewest goals conceded, 33, which shows really the evolution of Italian football, that the best defence in Italy over the last 12 months conceded slightly more than a goal a game. I mean, it is genuinely the most exciting, most attacking league in Europe at the moment.
Which people will, like, guffaw at, but I think
it's wild.
It's easy to dismiss the league based on the fact that Juventus aren't playing well, or that Conte's job is, you know, forever in peril at Inter Milan because they kind of fluctuate between very good and very average. But the middling sides in the league, like Sassuolo, you know, Roma as well to an extent, they're not exactly middling. Lazio last season, there's plenty to get excited about when it comes to the chasing pack in Italy as well. I just think Juventus need to be defeated before people realise that, probably.
Yeah, I think the three best sides in Italy this season are, certainly by underlying numbers, are Roma, Napoli and Milan. Like, I mean, those are the three best sides in Italy right now. I mean, maybe Inter's in there as well. But Inter have kind of gone crazy this season. They're not playing like a Conte side at all. They're just scoring relentlessly. They're the top scorers in Italy, I think.
Yeah, Lukaku's been on it, hasn't he?
Yeah, and they're playing wide open games. You know, like, it's mayhem, really. And obviously, there's so much interesting tactical innovation there. And yes, teams have a lot of older players, but their ability to get something out of those older players is a sign of superior conditioning in a lot of cases. Yeah. I mean, what Henrik Mkhitaryan is doing out there right now is insane. And I think that when you see the way that, say, Atalanta succeeded in the Champions League last year, it's hard to write it off as, oh, well, these are just old players succeeding in Italy. I mean, there are old players succeeding in the Premier League as well. And I just think that it's maybe about a generation of outstanding talents being maximized by good managers rather than overall an easier competition. But I mean, the thing about Pioli as well is this is what I was saying about exceeding expectations. I mean, pretty much the first half of the year, constant rumors that he was being replaced by Ralf Rangnick.
Yeah.
A pretty poor start as well. Obviously then the coronavirus lockdown, which was especially brutal in Italy. This is with the youngest squad in Italy, who will probably need that extra little bit of guidance, that little bit of coaching, you know, working through things. And they've had a lot of squad turnover over the last couple of years. The fact they're the youngest squad in Italy as well, with a 39-year-old Ibrahimovic starting up front, is funny as well. But the quality they've got out of Ibrahimovic, the quality they've got out of Rafa Leao, you know, when Brahim Diaz has come in, he's looked like a player again.
Kessié's had a renaissance under him as well. And obviously Tonali's coming to the fore. Romagnoli has been a consistent performer, but is emerging as like that talismanic captain they wanted him to be, right?
Yeah, Teo Hernandez as well, one of the best attacking left backs in the world right now. And, you know, Davide Calabria, who's really, really popped in the defensive numbers this season. So it just seems to me like Pioli's done a fantastic job. I mean,
Calhanoglu as well. Sorry to interrupt, but like, there was a few players that were wrote off in a very big way last campaign. And it was hard to argue their corner, but he's been one of the best creators, you know, in the 2021 season so far, hasn't he?
Yeah, and I don't actually think their squad is all that, you know. Like, there are a few players I'd take, but there aren't. But it's not like they're absolutely rammed with talent and they were underperforming and a guy's come in and just got them playing again. Like, I think he is getting the maximum out of these players, right?
Yeah, and they're making much. I know when the numbers came out, they were massively in debt, but they've obviously been trying to run in a smarter fashion for quite some time, haven't they? Like, they bought Jens Petter Haugge from Bodo Glimt for like 3-4 million after, you know, a ridiculous amount of goal involvements in 20 plus games. And he looked like the best player on the pitch against Celtic. And that is not something that Milan would have done probably 10, 15 years ago, you know, shopped at that price point and made them a better player through coaching. They've been buying like established stars for a long, long time, haven't they? So it's nice to see them, you know, operate in a different way and do it successfully, I guess.
And I think it also shows that they've developed a plan. Like, the fact that they wanted Rangnick and Rangnick hasn't come in, but they're still making what I would consider Rangnick type signings, shows that actually the club established an idea of how they were going to operate going forward. And like said, like, we can plug different people into this, but we're going to operate the same way. And that's something that teams often don't do. And so I think that that really shows that now there is some direction there. And I kind of don't think Juventus are going to win the title this season. I don't know if Milan are going to do it, because I still think there are some frailties in that squad. But I think that Pioli, and maybe Gattuso as well, possibly deserves to be mentioned here. Mm. Pioli, to me, is the manager of the year in what he's accomplished versus what he was expected to accomplish, which was losing his job in May.
Yeah, I think I'd agree with that. And when you said Pioli, I instantly thought of Gasperini as well. Like, people will obviously expect me to mention Atalanta, but I think they're eighth this campaign, aren't they? Gasperini's had a big fallout with Papu Gomez recently. But of course, reaching the quarterfinals of the Champions League, you know, going toe-to-toe with they had a late surge, didn't they, in the league? And people thought they were going to pip Juventus for a little while to a deserved Scudetto. Definitely qualifies him for the shortlist. But I think Pioli is probably edging in because of the start of this season, right?
Yeah, I think so. So shall we move on to breakthrough player? To be honest with you, I've got some research here, but I can't really be asked. Like, do you have an alternative to Erling Haaland?
I mean, Haaland and Fati were the top of my list. I've also gone Camavinga, Bellingham, Szoboszlai. Like, it's easy to forget that Szoboszlai, Vinicius Jr. as well, for example, are still 19 because people have been banging on about them forever. But they're still very, very young. But yeah, I've gone, my top three were Fati, Haaland and Camavinga. And I ended up going for Camavinga, you know, just because, like, one, extremely bored of talking about Haaland. And two. I just think Camavinga. I mean, he was kind of more impressive at the start of 1920, I guess. No, his numbers kind of held across like January to the end of the season as well. But he looks like he has the potential to be. I know. I hate saying like has the potential to be an all-time great, but the numbers he was putting up at such a young age were absolutely frightening. And in defensive midfield as well, or central midfield, like when a centre midfielder breaks onto the scene, that really gets my juices flowing, Patrick. Because I do think it's easier for strikers to come to the fore when they're a little bit younger, but to be able to run games as a 16, 17-year-old in the middle of the park for Ren to put up almost six defensive actions, to actually see a spike in your numbers at that age while you're playing in the Champions League is truly like the origin story of a great for me. So I do think Camavinga deserves to be in this conversation.
Yeah, to me, I mean, I guess you're right. Like for him to do it at that age and in that position, it is pretty exceptional. But I guess I just thought, to me, this was a straight shootout between Haaland and Alphonso Davies.
Yeah. Alphonso Davies, yeah. I mean, Christ, I forget that he's still 19.
Yeah, and the level that they've competed at this year, obviously, you know, Haaland actually did win a title. He won the Austrian title last season. And Davies obviously won a treble. The level they competed at, Davies as well, you know, like the performances he put in, particularly against Barcelona in the Champions League, were remarkable. Out of position at his age. Yes, I've criticised his positioning, but his recovery pace is such that it often doesn't matter. Yeah. And what he adds in attack is so incredible. I mean, I also think about those. I think it was the away game at Chelsea in the knockout stage where he was just unplayable, like blitzed down the wing constantly and they had nothing to deal with him. So, I mean, but I think if I had to bet on Davies, Camavinga, Fatty, Haaland, which one is going to become a genuine superstar? Haaland is the safe choice, right?
I think like Haaland's there, isn't it? He's just there.
Yeah, he is.
I imagine that release clause is going to be activated, right? Does that come into play in the summer, the 60 million release clause?
I thought it came in the summer after.
Right,
but
okay.
I'm not entirely sure. I mean, I guess as well, the thing you'd want to point out about these guys, a lot of them have been injured. You know, Haaland's out injured now. Fatty's out injured now. Who is the other guy? Davies has obviously been in and out this season. So
what about Saka as well?
Yeah, Saka's had a really good breakthrough season, but at the same time, Saka's numbers are like good for a youngster.
Yeah,
and like Saka's good enough to start in a bad Arsenal side. His numbers are pretty good, but they're not like good for anyone. Whereas Haaland's numbers are good for anyone. Camavinga's numbers are good for anyone.
Yeah.
And there's a difference, isn't there? I think sometimes a young player breaks through and everyone says, God, this guy's amazing. You know, it happened with Mason Greenwood as well, where everything he hit went in and people were like, he's going to be this incredible forward who scores all the time. And it's like, no, sometimes you just have a hot streak. And if you have that hot streak at the beginning of your career, people think you're going to be an all-time superstar. And you might end up being a very good player. If you're playing at that age, you probably will be. But I think people often don't have that right balance between this guy looks like he has the materials to be a star.
Yeah.
And this guy is a star right now.
Mm.
And so Saka, yeah, I think Saka's an incredible prospect. He and Martinelli, I think, are really exciting. And actually, Arsenal's youth players are very exciting overall. But how many of them should really be starting for a team like that now? Maybe Martinelli, maybe Saka, but you'd want to... They shouldn't be starting every game, really.
Mm. Yeah, I think Fatty and Haaland, this will be like the last time we can talk about them in this sense before they just go on to be bona fide superstars. Whereas you know, Camavinga will maybe, you know, another year under his belt, maybe we'll still be talking about him as sort of on the cusp of breaking through. I think Haaland's probably the right shout.
Okay, well, shall we move on to our own awards?
Let's do it.
How many have you got?
I've got three.
Nice. I've got three as well. Do you want to start me off with the first? Actually, tell me what your award titles are, not who's won.
Okay.
But I want to see what you've gone for.
I've gone for Best Renaissance.
Ooh.
I've gone for Twitter Account of the Year.
Okay.
And I've gone for the annual and very important and storied award of Football Daily's best bloke of the year.
Oh, okay. I've got feel good story of the year, and I'm pretty certain your best bloke and my feel good story are going to be the same. Okay. So should we get?
Are we just going to agree that's Marcus Rashford?
It's Marcus Rashford. mine specifically says Rashford fighting Tory scum.
Yeah, nice.
But yeah, it's got to be Marcus Rashford, right?
Yeah, Tory's worst nightmare. Young, black, intelligent, with a very clear message that he doesn't accept child hunger as a thing in one of the most developed economies in the world. So yeah, I think Marcus Rashford, thoroughly deserving of his MBE, and I can't even think of anyone that comes close to him in a off the field sense this year, or maybe just outside of their sport, like across the spectrum of sport. Does anyone even come close?
I think some players have taken stands on particular issues. But yeah, I mean, there's a difference between taking a stand and getting as much accomplished as Rashford has. I mean, like, if you haven't followed this that much, it's like, just to quickly say that basically Rashford first raised £20 million to provide food for children in food poverty during the first lockdown in the UK. Then he petitioned the government to extend the free school meals program across the school holidays. And ultimately, it's resulted in the government committing, I think, £400 million over the next year to help pay for food and household bills for poorer families across the UK. So, I mean,
yeah, because it would have just been one of those things the Tories swept under the carpet had it not been, you know, had he not leveraged his profile to sort of bring it back into the public eye. Like, they're yet to deliver on 53 of their campaign promises, 53, 54 from the 2019 election campaign. Like, these people are just barefaced liars, and Marcus Rashford was just like prepared to call them out on their, like, one of their many shortcomings, wasn't it? And I also really liked, you know, how he uses his Twitter timeline. Basically, he's clearly got a very good team around him who he managed to sort of galvanize local communities, local businesses, didn't he, there was a bit of a call to arms for them to give away free food in that interim period when the government hadn't quite agreed to the second round of free school meals, right? The Christmas ones. So yeah, just what a bloody legend.
Yeah, I mean, it's a... God, I don't know.
It's sad. Is that what you're going to say? It's sad that, like, the moral arbitrator for our country is, you know, is a footballer and not someone in government, or, you know, a civil servant that's supposed to be working for us. But
yeah, I'm kind of sick of us praising footballers for doing things that governments are meant to do. But I also think that he didn't just show up the government this year. I think he showed up journalists, because when you say the Tories would have swept it under the rug, I think they're allowed to do that by a journalistic establishment which has no interest in challenging the status quo. And I think it actually really frustrated me that I was seeing so many stories about what a great guy Marcus Rashford is, when all these journalists wouldn't have said anything about the issues themselves if it weren't for Rashford publicising them. So I think he shone a light on quite a dark part of the establishment this year. But he himself, I think everyone can be really excited about him and about how young he is. And generally speaking, I think, you know, this is something we've seen across the US and the UK, and actually across a whole heap of countries, which is that, like, younger people are more politically engaged and more community engaged probably than they've been for a long time. And as a result, hopefully we'll see a little sweep leftwards. But should we move on to your second award?
Mm.
What was it? It was best Renaissance of the year.
Yeah, and I was trying to think of someone that had maybe been dismissed and then came back to the fore that was maybe a little bit younger rather than at the tail end of their career. And mm-hmm. I was sort of thinking of Renato Sanchez and Locatelli when I started thinking of this segment. Can you think of any other outstanding candidates? I did go for Renato Sanchez. I haven't checked up on him in recent weeks, but do admire the way that he's sort of come back from the brink, you know, after that Swansea loan move to be a really important part of a really impressive Lille side under Christophe Galtier. And like him, Ikone, Bamba, who else is impressive in that side? Like Timothy Ware, when he gets a game, I think is a good little striker. I think that Lille are a very good side, and he's kind of, at least for a period of time, was the fulcrum of that midfield. So I like his narrative, mate, because we see a lot of players, you know, go, you know, fall by the wayside when he was, you know, in his position, and it's nice to see the reversal of that, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, the two who come to mind are Mkhitaryan, who we spoke about before, and maybe Manuel Neuer, who got a lot of credit this year. Though when I looked at his numbers and his performance relative to expectations, I was like, I mean, this is one of those things where he makes a save from an offside shot in the Champions League final and everyone's like, he's the best goalkeeper in the world again. But I do think he had a genuinely very good year. Just maybe slightly overrated. Other than that, it's a tough one. I don't think I've got anyone else really. Like, so Renato Sanchez, I think, is a really good shout here because he was written off, really.
Yeah, I mean, to be what? Did he cost? I always get confused. Was it between 30 and 60? I
think it was 35.
Yeah. I mean, between 30 and 60 is a huge, a huge gap. But 30 and 60 are the numbers that pop in my mind. But yeah, to win the Golden Boy Award, to fail pretty significantly at a big club and then fail again at a smaller club in the most, you know, widely reported league in the world, and then quietly rebuild your career is, at that tender age, without going off the rails, I think, yeah, makes him a deserved recipient, mate.
Yeah, I completely agree. Okay, my first individual award, I've gone for most boring football discourse of the year, nice. Which I think is an extremely strong category. Mm. There are so many conversations around football which are incredibly repetitive and boring, and I'm sick of them. I mean, there's the Pogba, will he stay, won't he? Is he a leader, isn't he?
Yeah.
That's very tedious. Aubameyang should play through the middle. That was a fun one. Grealish should be playing for England. That was a good one. Like, generally speaking, these are so boring. And, you know, every manager who comes in, there's always a comparison to the manager before where they're like, did you know that after 50 games, they've actually got the same number of points? I don't care. Like, it's so tedious. But what I went for in the end was handball / VAR.
Oh, Christ, yeah.
On the one hand, handball is a conversation we need to have because I think the rule makes no sense. I think everybody kind of looks at a replay of a handball and has literally no idea whether it's going to be given as a penalty or not. And I don't think that should be the case for people who watch the game a lot. Like, I think you should have some idea of what constitutes a handball and what doesn't. And I also think the handball rule was brought in to stop people to differentiate football from rugby. And now it's at a point where, like, if you're facing away from the ball and you're in the corner of your own box and the ball bounces up off your foot and hits your hand, then it's going to give the opportunity for like an 85% scoring chance for the other team. And that just seems absolutely ridiculous. But yeah, VAR, I think VAR is just the most boring one. Like, some version of VAR is going to stick around forever. Like, it's extremely hard for things to hit a kind of technological peak and then to retreat from that. And I think that if all the rules made sense, like handball, like offside, then actually VAR wouldn't be as much of an issue. Mm. But because those rules don't make sense, it compounds the problem. And it's just so boring. Like, after every game, I mean, I have no sympathy for the pundits saying it's boring talking about it after every game because they love talking about incidents. Like, one of the things we've always hated about traditional punditry is the fact that it always focuses on incidents. It's like, let's have a really long conversation about whether this was a penalty or not, rather than focusing on why X team was able to impose their game plan on Y team. And I don't know. I kind of feel that without VAR, we'd be having very similar conversations about, like, was this enough contact to justify the player going down and getting a penalty, which is a conversation we had for the last, you know, as long as I can remember in football, there's been that conversation. So I think it's disingenuous to pretend that VAR is the cause of it. But I don't know. I'm just so sick of it, man. I'm so sick of people talking about it. I'm so sick of people complaining. Like, when they VAR it and it's like, oh, God, his knee's off. Is that where football is? It's like, yeah, his knee's off. Like, if you're offside, you're offside. It's a binary state. Like, so, I don't know. I'm just bored of hearing about it. And it contributed to my decision to kind of come off Twitter this year.
Yeah, can we open up on that? Because a lot of people have been asking me when you're back.
I don't know. If I'm, I don't know if I'm going to go back. Like, I quite like Twitter as it is now, which is that, like, there are accounts I can go to if I want to read their opinions, but I don't have this constant, like, kind of chatter going on. Yeah. And I mean, it wasn't, that makes it sound like it was like Football Daily people like tweeting at me and that was pissing me off. And it wasn't really, like, it was just frustrating in the summer. Like, I found it was a difficult decision because social media was really making me feel like I was still in contact with people over the summer. But I don't really have many friends on Twitter. Like, my friends I talk to on Instagram or WhatsApp or whatever. And so in that sense, it didn't feel like that much of a loss. And I was just like feeling obliged to read everything. And then some people I know were also saying stupid things, not about football. And I just thought, then when I talked to those friends later, I was like, I'm kind of pissed off with you because like you just said this stupid thing and I want to kind of have it out with you. And that's just not a healthy situation to be in. Like, people just tweet out. I'm a bit older than most of my friends who are on Twitter, and I think that they are used to tweeting out like fairly shallow thoughts on there, which then don't bother them later. Whereas when they do that, I read it and I'm like, that's your real opinion, and it kind of pisses me off. So I don't know. I don't think it's a particularly healthy place for me to be. And now there are like one or two accounts, like I say, that I can go to and like read their opinions. Like, if I'm watching an Arsenal game, like, they see things that I don't see. But yeah. I don't know, really. Like, I think it's just...
Well, that's fair enough. I think in general, it's a good rule to streamline your use of social media. And if you've already identified that as like a... Like, I did it with Facebook. I was like, this isn't something I use. And like, it's going to have very little impact on me if I close my account. But it will... ultimately mean it's going to be one less thing for me to click, and I might save an hour a week by doing it, and then I'll save, you know, 50 plus hours a year, which I can pour into something else, something more meaningful. It's like I've done it with pretty much everything apart from like my Instagram game, pretty poor. Did it with Snapchat, did it with Facebook, so I totally get it. Like, I quite like that feeling of being lean, and if I feel like I'm investing unnecessary hours into something that I'm not really bothered if I engage with it in the first place, it's time to go.
Yeah, I mean, I've had Twitter off my phone for like a year and a half. I was like, it's not worth it. And then a couple of times earlier this year, I just found that whenever I pick my phone up, I was like automatically opening Instagram. And so several times this year, I've deleted Instagram for a week or 2 weeks, especially during lockdown where I kept seeing people like, oh, I'm out with my friends, and they had like their arms around their friends or whatever, or like, or just any of that shit. I was just like, this does not make me feel good. It makes me angry. I don't like that my thumb basically opens Instagram without my brain's involvement. Like, that's not good for me. So I go through periods of deleting it and then I put it back on. But I don't think I'll ever fully get off Instagram. Whereas, yeah, I go to Facebook maybe once every 2 years. Basically I logged out of my Twitter account. I got my wife to change my password and not tell me what the password is, so that if I ever do want to go back, I can, but it requires more effort than I'm willing to put into it. So yeah, I don't think Twitter's really on the cards for me. But I also think, you know what, I'm 31, like, it's time to be dignified and get off fucking Twitter. Like, if you're still arguing with people on Twitter when you're in your 30s, then it's like, it doesn't matter whether you're arguing about football or politics or anything, you're not doing God's work, you're like just being a knob. So shall we move on to our final awards? I think, like, what's your last award?
What a segue into Twitter account of the year.
Oh yeah,
unbelievable. I've actually gone with,
if this is your own account.
Yeah, I follow very few footballers,
sure,
or even like journalists, to be honest, because I quite like, I just use it as a forum or whatever to engage with our fans, or yeah, to I actually think the standard of like fan media or like fanalists in football,
yeah,
in the last couple seasons has gone through the roof. Like, definitely. This is something that was our USP 4 or 5 years ago. And we were maybe talking about, we added the stats or whatever to our lexicon you know, ahead of the game. But now people have caught up with us, and there are people that just produce an unbelievable quality of work in their spare time and throw it on a blog, and it's better than the mainstream media. Like I think that the average quality of fan coverage on football is extremely high, and I guess this has kind of been the case with American sports for a little while, right? Like academics have been writing about baseball since the 1950s or whatever, but I think if there's one area where like professional, I don't know, journalists, let's say, are being made redundant, it might be football media because the fans are bringing the f-ing noise, man. So that's why I've kept Twitter. One of the few footballers I follow is Martin De Roon.
Interesting.
Keeps me connected to Atalanta. Has a really like weird offbeat sense of humor. Like makes little montage videos of himself, and it's just generally like he has that awareness that like, oh, I was at Middlesbrough 3-4 years ago, and now here I am in a Champions League quarter final. Like, isn't this bizarre? Like, isn't this funny? And I'm just going to enjoy this journey while it sort of lasts, kind of thing. And it's quite refreshing to see like a normal, you know, just quirky footballer being himself on the platform. And he's like one of those guys that's like, I don't know, if he wasn't a footballer, like he might be working at, I don't know, like Game or something. Like he's a bit of a nerd. So yeah, I quite like Martin De Roon. Keeps me like I said, connected to Atalanta as well.
Oh, we'll see how many extra followers he gets after this after this show as a result of that shout out. Yeah, I think that's a good one. I don't have an alternative, though. I know that I've never followed any footballers on Twitter, but every now and then, like, someone would like retweet Cesc Fabregas into my timeline. Yeah, and I was like, he seems to say like intelligent stuff.
He says nice stuff about young footballers who are like being unfairly criticised. Like, I think because he goes out of his way to kind of provide that sense of balance or perspective as someone that's been there as a 16-year-old, right, in a first team. So he is class on that front. Go on then, let's flip it. Let's go, like, what's your favourite Instagram account, football or non-football, if you're more geared towards that platform?
I don't follow any football Instagram accounts.
So I'm thinking maybe a food one?
Ooh, I do like food ones, but when you diet like I do, they're incredibly annoying.
Yeah, because they're all cheese. They're all molten cheese.
Yeah, though, cheese has got out of control on Instagram. Like, people just putting, like, you know, like a bucket of cheese over a burger or whatever. It's like, come on, man. Like, like, let have a word with yourself, America. What do I like? I like Architectural Digest. Nice. I'm quite interested in architecture. And so if you like interior design and architecture, then that's obviously a good one. Oh my God. I'm trying to think of ones that are just not people I know.
It's very rare that you go searching for an Instagram account as well, isn't it? You don't like hop onto Instagram then hop onto your favorite account. It's like, what's on my feed?
Yeah. And I don't follow like just hot people on Instagram except for Salma Hayek.
I find like guys that have girlfriends, I don't know, that like pictures of hot girls as well, I find a little bit odd.
Though I will say that what's funny is if I ever find myself looking at a picture of a hot woman on Instagram, Zach Jellup has always liked it. Zach Jellup has liked every picture of like a hot girl on Instagram. And I mean girl, like these are like 21-year-olds.
Do you know what? Mine's Dave Horner. Like me and him, I don't know, maybe have similar interest in women. Like if I'll be recommended posts that he's liked now, and they're always like thick, you know, Latino women. And I'm just like, okay, Dave, great work. You're doing it for me. Like, I'm living vicariously through Dave's likes, basically.
Yeah. I mean, I Salma Hayek, I follow her. That's enough for me.
Nice.
Yeah, I don't really know. I genuinely don't know now I think about it. There's a friend of a friend called Anocam, A-N-O-C-A-M. He's a Londoner, but he lives in Tokyo. And he's like an amateur photographer, but, you know, like a pro-am photographer. Like, he's very, very good. And so if you're interested in Japan or just like really, really great photography, because Tokyo is an incredible subject, and he also goes off to, you know, Kyoto or into the mountains, which are incredible. then he takes really, really amazing pictures and puts up these little videos of himself like walking around like Akihabara or Shinjuku or whatever, like all your favorite regions of Tokyo. So that's really, really fun. Mm. And he's kind of, I think he's got a sensibility that is kind of like mine. So, you know, he'll put stuff up with like weird pastel or like vaporwave colors, and again Tokyo lends itself really well to that. So
does he put pictures up of himself in fancy dressing gowns or any bath snaps like you do?
You know, he doesn't.
That's disappointing.
But well, it's just not entry level shit. Like you've got to like the game chooses you, and I've got to say I've barely posted on Instagram actually since lockdown. I've posted like 3 times. But I do need to bring back some bath snaps, so maybe I'll put up some like slutty Insta pics after this. Who knows? Over Christmas, like I'll get in the hot tub and get some pics out.
You absolutely can't argue with the variety of conversation we've had on this show. Like, who would know? I know. We've gone from like Tokyo to Molten Cheese to Martin Darun to Bodo Glimt. So
yeah, it's been very, very wide ranging. So let's end on a down note.
Oh, nice. Yeah,
Disappointment of the year. Oh, I've got.
Oh, punchy, spicy. Hit me with it.
I think it's obvious where I'm going, right? I've got to go for Mikel Arteta.
Yeah.
Now, I don't think everything at Arsenal is due to Arteta. I think he's got a lot of old players there who he's had to sideline, and I don't think they react well to that. And we're starting to hear some stuff behind the scenes, which is always a great sign for a manager. I think that Edu is a bigger problem for Arsenal.
Mm.
Like I think if Arsenal hired Pochettino but kept Edu, I think they'd have a lower ceiling with Pochettino and Edu than they would with like Arteta and Ralf Rangnick.
Yeah. I can see the rationale there. Like I think
Yeah. The squad's a mess. But
do you think it was his handling of people that he'd sort of deemed Emery signings that has led to unnecessary friction? Like, so I've been pretty bullish that Arteta is a good coach and like he's got good tactical nous or whatever, right? But like when you see Saliba rotting in the reserves or not registered in the squad, or you see Torreira sent out, maybe you know when he had something left to prove still, and Guendouzi handled the way he was, you know, rather than just being sort of disciplined, he was exiled. Do you think that's created unnecessary drama and made the squad more unnecessary threadbare, let's say, because he is to blame for that then, if that's the case?
I think some of the drama is because the squad was too big. Like, we sent a couple of guys out on loan and we still had to leave a couple of guys out of the squad because we had too many. So I think, he had all this talk of non-negotiables, you know, and I think was trying to show that he was like not everyone's mate and that he was going to be a hard ass. Yeah. And I think that's okay. But then
it's a hard path to follow in modern football, isn't it? Like being that totalitarian.
And it's compounded by, well, if you're getting results, it's okay. But I think he's also done quite a bad job this year. Like, I mean, if Partey had been fit, I think that probably things would have been a bit better. He could have played more of a pressing style, which he's done over the last few games. Arsenal have pressed a lot more, whereas they were one of the weakest pressing sides in the league before that. Mm. So maybe he's just decided, like, God, I've just got to commit to like what my eventual plan was now because nothing's working and we can't be worse. But fundamentally, Arsenal right now are playing like a kind of 14th, 15th. But actually, I think expected points puts them like 11th. But Arsenal are currently playing like barely above the relegation level.
Yeah.
I don't think anyone can look at that squad and say it's relegation level. I don't think that there's evidence that everyone has downed tools, which would, you know, be extenuating circumstances, because I think people are still trying quite hard. You know, like I don't want to defend Granit Xhaka because I've never liked him and I think he's an idiot. But like, I don't think that he was so aggressive over the weekend because he didn't care. Mm. I think it's because he's a moron. And he couldn't control himself, and everyone's so frustrated and upset afterwards. But
and there's clearly people in that team that support Arteta like wholeheartedly. Kieran Tierney's post-match interview,
yeah,
I can't remember who it was, but he was saying like we're lucky that we have Arteta at this point, and that's why we're so confident we could turn it round. So there's clearly people that have subscribed to his way of thinking. It's just maybe the way he's dealt with people that haven't, or that people are a little bit like, on the fence, I guess. But then that's very hard to say from the outside looking in, isn't it? Like, it's there's a clear disconnect with, like, you know, half the changing route. Like, there's a division there, isn't there? And I don't know how they're hard to heal, aren't they? Yeah,
the Ozil situation, I think, didn't help. And then
Socrates
But also, I think he kind of convinced himself. I think maybe once he started working with the players, he started to say, you know what, I can see potential here. And almost like the fact he was able to get players to buy in made him then too confident. So, like, he talked Xhaka around when Xhaka was probably going to leave last January. And then in the summer, he was like, you know what, there's a place for Ainsley Maitland-Niles. But then he just doesn't really play these people, or he doesn't really use them very well.
Even
and it's
David
almost
Luiz.
Like he's...
Like, I remember David Luiz and him, the way they're embracing after the FA Cup final. I think I remember tweeting out something like, this is what loyalty to your player looks like, because he carried on playing David Luiz despite, like, a whole bunch of criticism, right? When Luiz was close to conceding, what, the most amount of penalties in a season. And then he's apparently the one leaking, according to, you know, various reports. I think I read it in London Football, it might have been, so I don't know how valid that is, but he's apparently the one, you know, that's been accused of leaking things to the press. So it's all very odd, isn't it? And it all feels very personal. It's not like Arteta can just get down to business, so to speak.
I still think, I'm still quite confident about Arteta as a manager somewhere. I think quite often managers do have weird times. And I do think that this Arsenal squad needs to be completely turned over. And that is going to happen, like, over the next couple of years. Like, in the summer, you're going to see Socrates, Mustafi, Ozil, Luiz all leave on free. Ceballos will go back to Real Madrid. They'll probably sell Kolasinac and Lacazette. And suddenly then, you know, you've got a bunch of young players coming in and maybe they look a bit more coherent. But the question of whether Arteta lasts till then is a real one. And I don't think relegation is totally off the table.
Wow.
But I think it's mostly off the table because the teams below Arsenal are genuinely awful and Arsenal are underperforming their expected points right now. And it's hard to see how they play. It's hard to see how they play worse. And they're not in the relegation zone now. So they would need to get worse. But you know, this is what it looks like when a team like... This is what it looks like when a team like does kind of get a shock relegation. Like, things aren't going against them. They get some key injuries. Everything falls apart. The players down tools. They don't sign the right players in January. And suddenly you're in a battle. And I don't think that that's going to happen.
No, there's some horrific teams in the league this season.
Yeah.
But the fact that's the saving grace shows how, you know, far Arsenal have fallen. And like you said, it's not a matter of kind of reverting to the mean and that they've been unlucky. Their underlying numbers suggest they deserve to be where they are, which is the alarming thing.
Yeah, that is the alarming thing. So I think it's been a bad year, but if you gave me a choice between sacking Arteta and sacking Edu, I'd still sack Edu. But that's not to say Arteta's done a good job. It's just that I believe Arteta can be good.
Yeah, and that's why I'm invested in Arteta now, because I'm now building a sort of resistance to, like, you know, people who adopt a very talk sport approach of, like, well, he's now we were praising him after he won the FA Cup, but now he's lost six games, or what was it, four games at home on the bounce. He's all of a sudden definitively terrible. Like, yeah, it's hard to defend your standpoint at the moment that there's something to Arteta because of the form book. But, like, that makes me want him to prove the doubters wrong even more, I guess. A disproportionate amount, but yeah.
Yeah, and some of the managers as well who are getting praised right now had these bad periods as well. Like people were kind of angry at Carlo Ancelotti just under a year ago, like not long after he came in. Rodgers had a pretty down period over the back half of last season where people were like, God, this has got boring. Ralph Hasenhüttl obviously lost 9-0 to Leicester, and people are like, my God, this is like one of the greatest humiliations in Premier League history. And now, you know, and Dean Smith almost got relegated. And now everyone's saying, well, these guys are phenomenal. Like, they've got much better managers than Arsenal do, or Man United do. And I think, well, you've got to have the right tools. And I'm not, this is not defending Arteta's the job he's doing. It's just that I believe that he can be better. I think that that's not true for other people.
Yeah, that's fair.
But it's undeniably been a horrific year. but it's also sort of funny now. I'm now at the point where I find it kind of funny, and I at least look at the youngsters, and the youngsters make me happy. I look at Bukayo Saka and I'm like you're from Ealing. Like all the Hale End boys, like Balogun, Nketiah, less so Willock, not really a big fan. Smith Rowe, Saka, all these guys. Maitland-Niles, definitely. I've always loved Ainsley Maitland-Niles. Like all these guys, I look at them and I'm like, yes, I want you to be a success. And now I'd add Saliba and Martinelli into that as well. I want them to be stars. And I think Martinelli will be a star. I think Saka will be a star. Others, the jury's out on. But they are a bright spot in an extremely dark season for Arsenal.
Yeah. And that's not me saying like the fact I want him to do well isn't me saying he's beyond criticism, because that is the stance people take, right? Oh, you think he's good, but he's not doing very well at the moment. And it's like, yeah. I know, but I'm going to be consistent with my messaging regardless. So, fuck him.
Yeah, fuck him. Well, thanks very much for joining me, Chris.
No worries.
I'm not actually sure when this is going out. I suppose it'll be...
sometime over Christmas.
Yeah, it'll be like the 29th or something, I guess. So I don't know if there's anything you want to point to, but do you have a message for our listeners / viewers over Christmas?
Beyond thanking them just for sticking with us through what has been a bit of a turbulent period, not an awful lot. Let's just say I hope we get back to the studio next year. We've always tried to raise our production values year on year, haven't we? We do take great pride in the sort of quality of work that we produce, and that's been difficult to manage this year. So let's hope that is a situation amended next year, and yeah, let's hope then we can crack on with bigger and better. I think we're all pretty sick of staring down a webcam. I'm very, very surprised you've not, you know, got more bored of staring at us on a webcam. So thanks.
Yeah, well, I think that pretty much says everything. We hope that you guys have a really good holiday. And that things are a little bit better in 2021. It feels like there might be a little bit of light. Obviously not for Arsenal fans, but for everybody else. So thank you very much for listening. Thank you very much for listening or watching. Make sure that you subscribe to either Football Daily Podcast on YouTube or subscribe to our podcast. Leave us a review if you'd like. We always enjoy that. And we'll see you in the new year. Bye, guys.
Bye.